Hi, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about metagaming in your role-playing game like D&D. How much is acceptable? Where is the line? What is it? What should you do to punish players who step over the line?
Why don't we start with what is it? Because I'm not even sure if we can agree necessarily on that.
Well, this is a surprisingly good point, and of course, Paul brought this up 30 seconds ago, and I'm completely unprepared for it. So unfortunately, that word gets used in a lot of ways. And to begin with, like I was trying to do a search a couple hours ago, and first of all, there's a company in the 70s that was named that. So if you do try to search some of this stuff, you are going to run into the Metagaming Company, or what was called Metagaming Concepts to begin with. And they published Stellar Conquest and Steve Jenkson's Ogre Game. We're not talking about them.
No. We're talking about a concept right here, something that happens in your role-playing game. I'm looking at, actually, so believe it or not, Wikipedia has an article specifically about metagaming in role-playing games. They describe it as, if I can summarize, sort of using real-life knowledge from the player's perspective to determine their character's actions. That can be anything from knowledge the player has from their own past versus just perceptive knowledge of things that they know or are aware of what's going on in the game outside of what the character should be aware of. There you go. It says,
Go ahead. You go ahead. You're looking at it.
I just like that they say metagaming is an example of breaking character, which is, there's a lot of nice sort of... acting conceits we can use here, like breaking the fourth wall, right, as metagaming is coming, taking out of game into game, out of game knowledge in game.
Right. So in role-playing games, obviously, I think we agree it's generally used as a pejorative.
Yeah.
I think that in some other, maybe non-role-playing games, like collectible card games, or you mentioned mobile games a little while ago, it's more of a non-pejorative discussion of the context around the game or what you do to in preparation or planning before you come to the game table.
Yeah, I mean, I see this a lot in my day job making mobile games, is that often the metagame is the part of the game that is not the thing you're constantly doing, right? It's the, like, if I'm playing Star Trek Timelines and I'm collecting crew to go send them on away missions, sending them on away missions is the game. But the collection and the management of my collection is the metagame.
Right. And I think I've also seen that in, tabletop miniature, wargaming. I think Warhammer players might possibly discuss that same, how do I construct the army before I come to the table? So in role-playing games, it does mean something different. It's usually pejorative of this breaking character and usually meant to unfairly using player knowledge to affect character actions. So I'll say, to me, this seems new schooly, right? So this was an issue that was discussed or that I was aware of in the late 70s or early 80s. And when I made my notes for this, I wrote down, this feels like a late 80s, 1990s issue to even come up.
I'm sure it's evolved over time. I think it relates quite a bit to that whole, like, how much separation. We did a whole video a while back about separation between player and character, right? And you go to the really early stuff, and it seems like the separation is almost absolute. Like, there is no character, right? I'm a player of a game, and I'm moving my men on the table because I've got a wargaming background, and I don't think about in-character at all.
Right. And the claim at the time, I mean, I never played this way, but the claim at the time is really, really early on, people didn't bother to give their characters names until they reached some somewhat higher level. Right. And they were, pretty close to disposable game pieces.
Sure, no more than you would name the pawns in your game of chess.
Exactly, exactly. And some people would. And I'm sure some people would, right?
That might make chess pretty interesting, actually.
Yeah, and then, you know, and then some, you know, someone will come on and argue with us that this was, you know, I named my pawns in chess, and this was just an obvious evolution, and D&D and role playing games have nothing really new to them whatsoever.
Yeah. So in that degree, I guess I agree that it's kind of new schoolish in that, like, like as that concept, as the play acting portion of D&D has become more prevalent, it's become more of a thing, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a way of interpreting that. And if initially characters were, you know, I mean, the other thing that I find is, so many things.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the funny thing is, as much as we want to classify this to say this is new school versus old school,
yeah,
I can't help but, because I happen to be sitting in front of a picture here from GaryCon, help but remember playing Brownstein with David Wesley.
Yeah.
I mean, metagaming must come up in that game. That game, to me, felt almost like playing a LARP. It was all play acting, almost no dice rolling of any kind.
Gotcha. And so when you say metagaming came up, are you saying like we're intentionally using non-character information, or we're intentionally avoiding using non-character information?
Excellent question. Yeah, I guess maybe there's not enough separation in that you're so, you know, playing as me in the mindset that if I overhear two people saying something, then I overheard two people saying something. If I'm standing near you, then my character's standing near you.
Okay.
Although, you know, certainly I'm remembering that game. Okay, so in that game, there was a portion where I was in prison, so I was told to go sit in a corner. And, you know, we only had so much physical space. We only had a room of a certain size. Yep. It'd be very easy for me to have leaned over and, like, listened in on some conversation that was meant to be happening down at the tavern. And then have used that.
Gotcha.
I mean, I didn't, because that's not the kind of player I am. But it would be surprising to me if in all the years he's been running that game that the problem has never arisen.
Gotcha. So this is one of the main topics when this comes up about, like, what does, if you're going to even engage in what does your character know discussions, mm-hmm, of what happens when the party gets split. And so there was a gentleman who has a blog called the Raging Owl Bear Blog, Raging Owl Bear Blog, which is a great title. And he wrote a post about this last year. And the thing that he specifically had to grapple with his own philosophy about metagaming was exactly it. This. They had a team scouting a castle. They sent one silent rogue ahead. Mm-hmm. And at that point, he made a decision to actually split the players up. He took the rogue character into a different room, played through the surveillance, and his idea to begin with was, they're separated, the rest of the party doesn't immediately get this information, I'm going to play through away, come back, and then you're going to have this interesting telephone game conversation whereby does the rogue successfully communicate what he or she saw.
Right.
And he was super disappointed with how that worked out. He considered that to be an enormous failure.
Yeah.
The other players weren't involved. It took way longer than he expected. They came back, and the rogue had all kinds of miscommunications based on what he, the DM, had told the rogue, and needed to fix that anyway. And so he was like, I will never do that again. I'm just going to, even if the party splits up, they can sit there, the other players will listen, and then we'll just, you know, automatically have the information that we'll pretend was told to them later on.
Yeah. I feel like you get that fairly commonly, right, when there's like a monster that only speaks a certain language and only one player speaks that language at the table. He knows Goblin, so he's going to translate. And then inevitably the other players just start talking directly to the DM. And at some point, the DM, I think a good DM, will just hand wave and say, like, we're just assuming your character is talking is behaving as the translator here.
Yeah. And likewise, I remember when I played in your Cthulhu-based game, and like you said last week, you commonly, to my amazement, commonly have parties split up. And obviously you keep both sides of the table at the same time.
Yeah.
And I was personally amazed at your ability to ping pong back and forth between the two groups at the table and have that be running really, really proficiently.
That's one of the joys of those kinds of games for me. Usually in those games, even right from the get-go, right, I'm giving people pre-generated characters, which have a little block of text for them to read about their character's background, but also means that some characters have some information that other characters don't have. And so part of the
right.
play is actually talking to the other players to get that information around the table.
Okay.
So that's a big part of it. I mean, that's one of my favorite games. I'm trying to think. I think it's actually that game that you played. The whole thing is set with there's an opening scene, and I describe in that block of text, I say, in the starting scene, here are your motivations, here's what you're doing. And I begin that game by saying, everybody read their starting scene block? Yes? Okay. Go. And then I do nothing for half an hour except run around like a lunatic trying to, what do you need? Do you need information? What are you doing? While they yell at each other, basically. Because they all have very different motivations, very, very different goals, and different pieces of the puzzle that they need to share with each other.
I was really impressed. So when we got past that and we had separate exploration segments.
Yeah,
so one half exploration here, one half exploration there, and you were interfacing with one half of the group while the split off party, three or four of us, were interacting in character and like arguing or debating what to do next. And it seemed like just about the time we had a decision, we could tell you what was going to happen. You'd gotten the other half of the table into a similar situation where now they're going to argue for 5 or 10 minutes and you could come back and interface with us about like what we get next. And then in the middle, there was a moment where we called each other, where we phone called the other side of the table. Right. But only one person was on the line. So I had to turn to the people that were supposedly with me and say, well, she's saying this, which doesn't make any sense. What am I going to tell her now? Right. And then I get back on the phone with someone who's across the table. So it was,
that was a delightful group of players who were able to pull that off. But a little bit there, we're playing with the concept of metagaming to our advantage, right?
The whole
point of that is that I do anticipate that everyone sitting around the table is observing everything that's happening and has, you know, is able to separate in their own mind, well, here's what my character knows and here's what my character will do based on that. But me as an observer of the game, I'm being entertained by knowing a little more than my character. And maybe even delighting in sort of seeing the foreshadowing happening over here. This is going to get too vague. Let me give a concrete example. Yeah. I ran a game, actually the same game you played, but with a different group, where one of the players split off and ran ahead of the group, was just like, I'm just going, and ran off, and then stumbled into many very perilous situations, really dangerous stuff, which in Cthulhu is amusing because, like, it's all stuff that shouldn't exist, right? So, there's no way that's real, right? So he's hitting all these horrible, horrible things, and meanwhile, there's three players in the group who are headed in the same direction at a much slower pace, and so they're getting the foreshadow repeatedly. They know what they're going to find as they move down the path, but they're also thinking to themselves, but there's no way I would believe that that's there even if he came back and told me.
Right.
So then it's hilarious. Then we're all laughing and having a great time as they stumble into every peril and and a little bit play it up, right? Like, they're more inclined to be like, what? Orcs don't exist? That's not real, right? Or whatever it is. And
It's nice. And, you know, the other thing about that, because, of course, that game itself is actually about D&D, right? So the game itself is like literally a meta game about the game of D&D, right? So you have at least two levels of playing with D&D tropes, including the whole systemic, like, are we aware of a barrier between player and character? So it really hits a whole lot of really clever levels.
It's a good point. Nothing really delights role players more than trying to role play a character in the 80s who doesn't know what role playing is.
Right.
It's just fun.
You should stream that. You should somehow get a group together and should actually stream that online, because actually people deserve to see that particular game.
I would love to. I'll write that one down. That's a thing I will try to do in the future. But besides crowing about my own delightful adventure writing skills, metagaming.
So let me bring it back to D&D, right? Yeah. So for me, if I go back to original D&D and the situation we're in, the situation is incredibly deadly, and the characters are very frail, and they could perish at any particular time, and the so when the metagaming critique came up in the 80s and 90s, and the debate about your character wouldn't know that, it just seemed really, it seemed aggravating and slow and removing us from the process of the play. And I think I found myself, irritated and uncomfortable with the whole, the whole meta discussion now. Hmm. Of now we're debating what your character would not know.
Well, I think part of it comes out, sorry, I just had a lightning bolt here. Part of it comes down to what are your motivations for metagaming, right? Are you doing it because it furthers the story and the enjoyment for everyone else at the table, as we were just discussing in those Cthulhu games?
Right.
Or are you doing it to cheat? Right?
Yeah, okay. So then there's a question like, what counts as cheating? So to me, right, so when players come to my table, and are wondering, like, is it okay if I use this knowledge, I usually wind up telling people, I encourage you, the player, to use every piece of knowledge in your head to your advantage right now.
Yeah.
Because the situation is incredibly perilous. You're probably going to die otherwise. You're probably going to die anyway. So please bring every strategic tool that you have in your kit to the table and try to survive this horrible situation. I'm happy that, some OSR people, I feel, finally found the right phrase for this of challenge the player, not the character. And I'm happy to have that phrasing as something that I can use to make sense of that.
There are extremes of this, though. I think there are cases where I'm right on board with you and I love it, and then there are cases where it's abusive. So for example, right, the classic is like, does my character know that trolls are susceptible to fire? Right.
Right.
In which case, I'm always like, you are. I think Finch had a wonderful line about like, you are the guardian angel of your own character.
Yeah.
Right, so, I don't know, invent a reason why your character has heard tales about how trolls are susceptible to fire, or just have them luck into it, like, oh, I swing this torch at him, what do you know, it worked. Whatever. I think all of that is fine, I have no problem with that.
And the Raging Owlbear blog used that exact same example for the exact same, resolution of, let's just assume that's common knowledge that gets told to school kids.
Great. So then, let me give you the other extreme.
Yeah.
As you know, I often like to use pre-written material. Some people in the OSR and otherwise make some great stuff, and they publish it, and I buy it, and I adapt it and work it into my campaign. And one day, I happened to walk by the desk of one of my players behind his back and saw on his screen the very adventure we were running.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what I on my notes, so there's some line here that counts as cheating. Right. And on my notes, that's it.
Yep.
Right. So players intentionally getting the prepared material and reading in advance, that I would consider clearly cheating. Right. And I mean, also, like, I've had a history, when we were very young, of players stealing the DM's materials.
Yep.
Right. Actually breaking and entering.
I mean, there's, with 5th edition and D&D Beyond, and we're all playing with tablets now, there's a very easy, innocuous way to say, like, I'm in a fight with this creature I've never experienced before. Let me open a new tab and look up that monster stats on D&D Beyond. I could do that.
Good point. Okay. And back in the day, theoretically, the player wasn't supposed to use the monster manual at the table.
Right.
And obviously that was easier to spot. That was just said yesterday, right? So I was just in a game, yesterday where, here's the monster manual for you to use as a clipboard. Please don't look in it while we're playing. So that still has to get stated.
Yep.
There's
a fuzzy line there, though, right? There's a fuzzy line between, like, I'm actively sifting through the manual, or I've just memorized stuff.
Yeah, or, and then the other line is, well, what if I'm a wizard and I have this polymorph spell? Should I not know what kind of things I'm polymorphing into?
Yep.
Or I have a summon spell. Should I not know the capabilities of the things that I'm summoning?
Yep.
That's a bit of a hazy line.
Yep. Yep. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that aside, right? That, documentation right in your face, that aside, if someone did actually sit down and memorize that stuff in advance, personally, I would be hard pressed to find a day where I would be bothered by that. And I don't think I've ever, aside from those things, I don't think I've ever been bothered by thinking that a player was using too much information. But that's interesting. So clearly we agree that like grabbing the adventure in advance is, I would count as cheating. Now, you accused me of cheating.
Excellent.
So here's where this gets contentious, because you accused me of cheating in our last game when I was counting up the dice you were rolling for a particular Dragon's Breath, right? Gently. And I was surprised by that. So for me, that wouldn't actually count as cheating. So I'm not entirely sure how serious you were about that, because I was a little surprised.
I'm personally still not sure myself. I you know, I checked my, like, I think my instinct at the time was like, what the hell is he doing? I couldn't, you were obviously counting the dice. And I went, what the hell? And I reached down and scooped up the dice, because I was like, stop that, right? And then I'm like, should I have stopped that? I don't know. Is that bad? I'm not sure. And to this day, I'm still not sure.
Okay, see, that's honest, right?
A little hazy on it.
Yeah. See, last week, right? So last week I had my characters fighting a dragon, and they were in terrible peril, and I was amazed that they survived. Mm-hmm. And I rolled a d20 for attacks, and I said, and the total is 25. And I saw one of my players look really hard at the die. Right. And I could see him doing a subtraction in his head. Didn't say anything about it. But for me, I was like, great. That's top level play, is you're using every piece of information to your advantage. And I enjoyed that. And then I was thinking about what happened when we played at your place. So I don't mind those, you know, like using number knowledge at the table. That's all fair game. And I enjoy seeing that.
Yeah. I mean, on the other hand, I guess I also enjoy, you know, in general, I like to roll in front of the players. Love doing that.
Yes,
and there is a moment of delight when I roll a 5, look at the player and say, does a 22 hit you? And they go, oh, God. Right? When they realize just how big a plus this thing has.
That's a great moment. I agree. That's a great moment. That happens, and yeah, that's totally. I hadn't thought about that explicitly, but no, that's totally beautiful.
That's a great moment. That's a great moment, because and then you're using it to your advantage. I don't know. I like that. So I guess if I like that, it's really hard for me to knock someone for doing the inverse, and saying like, all right, it looks like they have a +7 hit. Okay.
Yeah. I would encourage more. You know, more freedom of the information than that. I mean, so for me, it seems like, you know, generally avoiding, you know, minimizing the number of things that are restricted, or, you know, minimizing the number of things that you could possibly have this argument about, does your character know this, seems like it makes for a thinner interface between player and game. It feels like, you know, again, in the sense of the murky mirror, it just seems like one less thing to get in the way of engaging in the fight, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so I'm pretty happy having very few things that I'm going to prohibit in that regard, because then there's just fewer things I need to think about.
I also will say I very much prefer it when I see that the player is using that to better the game for everyone, right? Not just, I'm going to mentally count up the dice and now I know the number, and so now I know how I'm going to change my actions to survive this combat better. But like, hey everyone, my old auntie was once attacked by a troll and she threw a candlestick in its face and it ran away, so let's try fire. Like, that's great, right? I like that way more than the the more selfish, I'm just trying to get ahead
method. Okay. I'll see that. And I will say, you know, one thing that in the last couple of years that has pleasantly surprised me is, like, we have run now a number of times adventure, you know, maybe classic adventures that one of our play group has read in the past, mm-hmm. right? You did this at our house con in April. And that's really amazed me at what good sports everybody that we know is about you know, being honest about, well, I more or less don't, I know the theme of the adventure, I don't remember the details, not going to look them up again, and really being a really great player about maybe inserting little blurbs of information, like you just said, well, I heard a rumor that such and such, but I'm not totally clear where that is.
Yeah.
And once upon a time in my life, I never would have trusted that. And boy, that has worked, you know, so well.
That's really about trusting your play group. I mean, I think a big point here is probably this is a discussion you should have with your group, right? Like, sit down and talk about metagaming, what's acceptable, what's not. Try and outline what you do and don't like. Get everybody on board.
All right, I'm gonna challenge you on this one.
Okay, great.
So, you know, we talk about, we talk about have the discussion. We talk about session zero. Some people do, at least. How much do you really do that?
So here's a great example. So Murky Mirror came up, right? This came up when we were talking about player versus character separation, and I thought, oh, there's some good ideas here, things I want to use at the table. Yeah. I reworded Murky Mirror into something very light and condensed, and I posted that to my group Slack channel where we all play, where I play in that game, and I said, hey, everyone, we're going to do this now. Tell me your thoughts. Tell me if you think it's a bad idea. I didn't get a ton of reactions. The couple I did were generally like, sure, it sounds reasonable. And then since then, I've called people on it at the table. I'm like, remember, we're playing Murky Mirror, so blah, 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 blah. And everybody seems to be on board. So I think that's good. That's a win.
Okay, well, that's interesting, because maybe I'm a bad DM in that regard, because admittedly, I don't have session zero upfront discussion consent form type things.
I mean, the fact is, I rarely think to do this before we start play. Calling it session zero is a massive misnomer for me, because usually it's like session 3.7.
And
crap, we never talked about this thing. I'm going to go talk to them about it.
Okay, I think that's what I was trying to get to a certain extent. And I mean, I guess for me, I'm just so fortunate with having players that I trust explicitly all the while that it never occurs to me to feel like I need to say anything like that more than maybe just one sentence of just, if it, you know, they'll ask me and I'll say, you know, use all your knowledge. You're probably perish anyway, so please bring it as hard as you possibly can.
Well, I mean, that's let's talk about the famous Tomb of Horrors with our friend John.
Yeah, so for example, so we were maybe about 10 years ago now, we were playing a session of Tomb of Horrors. I wanted to run through that. I would run it very differently now, I'll say that. I was using basically first edition AD&D rules, which is what it was published for. And again, one of my main things now, any DMs that are going to run Tomb of Horrors, the first hallway has a hidden clue, has a hidden riddle, puzzle clue that is hard for the players to find. I'll just say that. And if they find it, that totally completely changes the context of how the players are going to interface with Tomb of Horrors. It changes it from just punishing brutality to a series of puzzles to figure out. I didn't know that until later on, because the players missed that, didn't quite do the right thing to find it, and then much later on, having gotten stuck many times, cast a commune spell, I think, right? And even though in the book that's supposed to be yes or no, I just said, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to read a slice. I'm going to read a couple lines slice out of this initial puzzle. I'm only going to say it once. And so I read the puzzle, and maybe I didn't even say that in advance, but I read the couple of clues of the puzzle. And then someone said, I didn't quite get that. Could you repeat that? And I hard asked it. I said, I'm only going to say that once. You're not going to get it again. And there was a big argument at the table. And then our friend John said, well, what if hypothetically someone had audio taped you saying that? Would it be permissible to play it back? And then there was an argument about, why are you bringing up nonsense hypothetical crap that didn't happen? And then John brings up his handheld audio recorder, and he actually had done that. So I had to make a decision about, is it fair game to use an audio recording device? And at least at that time, I said, yes, absolutely. I didn't see that. That seems really incredibly clever to me. I'm not going to, if you thought that to do that right here, I'm not going to take that away from you. Use the audio recording device. That's fine today.
That's I just want to point out, it's a pretty dry retelling of what was actually a hilarious moment. because he did it on the sly, did the recording, and then started posing a question in a very vague way of like, what if we had recorded that? Would that be okay? And then a huge argument erupts amongst the players. It doesn't matter. We got to figure out the puzzle. Like, I said, yeah, but what if we had a recording? Would that be like, but we didn't record it, so who cares, right? And it took forever for John Devine to be like, well, I did record it.
Yeah, well, the thing was, is he slowly, because he had it under the table, and he slowly raised up the device, and he's like, but I did
record it. Here it is. He was so trepidatious about that, right? Because he didn't know where the line was. He wasn't sure if he was cheating or not, and he didn't want to cheat.
There you go. And I was probably at most tables, I would assume the DM would say no. I think that that's a great legitimate concern. And he's doing the right thing, I think, to try to check in on that.
Right.
Yeah. But at least at my table, I even said yes to that. I don't know how much harder someone would have to push it for me to personally say no.
Right, right. And I mean, ultimately, like, you're using modern technology, and maybe that makes us go, well, that's a little odd. But like,
right.
As is mentioned in the chat here, what if he had written it down? You know, what if I just had a photographic memory and I was just able to recite it? Right.
Like, yeah.
You could have any of those things could have happened. And, you know, I think it's perfectly valid roleplay to say, well, my character has photographic memory, and he recites this. Press play.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the other thing is, like, as soon as I said I'm only going to say it once, I think part of my brain went, oh, dude, that itself might not have actually been the right thing.
I should have never said that.
Right. Yeah, maybe I should have written it down myself and handed it to them. Yeah, right. So that maybe the part of me was what do they call that in sports, like a referee doing a makeup call or something like that.
I mean, I love – so the funny is you mentioned that anecdote of the guy who took someone aside and made them do a scouting mission and then made them regurgitate the information.
Right.
I get why that didn't work. And frankly, my thoughts on why that didn't work is that, like, you then spent however much time alone with this player – who was not prepped for, like, oh, I better take notes because I'm going to have to regurgitate this.
Yes.
Right? And and you left the rest of the table sitting around bored.
Yes.
Let me give you a counterexample of something I did in one of my games that I love, is I had a character who had prophetic dreams. Now, this is something I prepared ahead of time, so you couldn't just do this on the fly, but I had a character who had prophetic dreams. And so I gave that character some photographs, and I said, these images represent your dreams. You can't show these images to anyone else at the table, but feel free to describe them in as much detail as you want.
Yeah.
And that was their way of, like, describing their dreams. Oh, I saw this room with this strange light. Oh, where, right? And the players are asking this. It was a great moment because it encouraged that role play of someone pretending to describe a dream that they hadn't actually had.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, like, I love the idea of, like, yeah, if you had just written it out and handed it to him and said, like, here's the poem, you can't actually show it to anyone. Eventually they're going to be like, well, I'm just going to write it down then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's fine. Write it down.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, to recap, I will say, and this is a side issue for the current topic, but it totally amazingly changed the play of Tomb of Horrors. Like, yeah. I could not get over what a different interface. So the next four, you know, I gave him four lines. The next four encounter areas were totally, we can figure this out. This was the clue. This was the riddle. I bet they're talking about this. Let's try this. We get through it. And then as soon as they got to the point of the end of the slice, you're back to classic Tomb of Horrors, just getting punched in the face repeatedly.
Yeah. I mean, that's the pro tip. Running Tomb of Horrors, give them the puzzle. Give them the riddle up front. Just give it to them. Just give it to them.
Please use my accidental science experiment, because I feel like that the amazing radical difference between without it and then with it and then without it is just give them the riddle. It's I could not believe what a difference in a play that made. And thanks so much to John for recording it. Otherwise, we wouldn't have gotten to actually find that out.
It was great. It was great.
Yeah.
So user Jay Raven's asking about divination spells. you know, I just want to underscore something that I really love is I don't think it matters how you get the information to the table, right? Whether you're using recording devices or whatever, divination spells, like you can, you know, talk like you're talking to a demon voice or write something down or whatever. But getting your players to incorporate it into the fiction of the game, that's my favorite. Like, bonus points to any player, right? Like, if I have, if I pass you a note and you say, I had a vision, and you roleplay out retelling your vision, that's aces. That's aces in my book.
Yeah, and I, you know what? I'm sufficiently gamist that I never stop being surprised. I never stop being pleasantly surprised when that happens, because I myself am not expecting that. And honestly, you know, when we streamed our last game, I actually was watching myself, and it's like I actually need to ramp it up a little bit more, because my standard, like, give me information, these are the dice I'm rolling, bust down the door, take the treasure, move on, I think I can personally do better about that, because even I am constantly pleasantly surprised when a player brings that extra depth of character acting in. I never stop being amazed by it. And we know a number of people who are really great at that, and it always really thrills me.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. The player in your brother Max's game 2 years ago, who had a physical phone and was receiving information from, I don't know, like a ghost or a devil that they identified as their mother or something like that, mm-hmm. and kept having these one-sided conversations on the phone with the demonic mother figure, was, I could not get over how amazing that was. I was completely convinced there was someone on the other end of the phone. There wasn't. He totally managed to conjure up not one, but two different character voices just by this apparently one-sided conversation he was having. It was stunning.
You know, this harkens back a little bit to, I think, what I was saying last week of, like, incorporating new players. I love to bounce that into the player's court. I love to just sort of set the scene. All right, you're tied up in a corner. When the players untie you, you better explain how you got there. Good luck.
You know what? Last week, this is so classic for me. Last week you said that, and I was like, nah, really? I don't think I would bother with that. I think I just want them on scene. They're part of the show, right? I don't think I would do this tied up in the next room and then explain why. I don't know. Okay, 3 hours later, I did that, right? three hours later, I was running a game and someone died and I needed a new character, and 100% that was exactly what happened. And in fact, I'll point out this. This happened while the party was exploring a pit, right? So there's a cave, mm-hmm. there's a dark pit down in nowhere, and before they get there, there's a rock with a rope tied around down into the pit, right? And it's taut. There's something at the end of it. And so when they slide down the rope, the new PC is actually the dead weight tied at the end of the rope they were sliding down.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
And then they had to explain how they got there. Did you bounce?
Well, you know what? I actually made that up myself. So I as DM, I came in and said it, and then the other players were, that seems suspicious. That seems slightly hard to believe, okay.
And then just to bring it back to our topic, you're relying on a certain amount of metagaming going on here. The players know that the other character died and that this player needs to be rolled back in, and you're expecting them to roleplay in such a way that, like, yeah, they might give him some grief of, what are you doing, why are you tied up down here? But they're going to bring him into the fold and they're going to go adventuring together.
Right, and as we said last week, I mean, I think that's a point where you just have to shatter the fourth wall to get the player into action. I think at some future point, I mean, just to tease a future show, I think we're going to talk about mind controlling magic, mm-hmm. and I think again the touchy point of debate there is the player involved in the action right now or not. And I think that's another place where it's going to be touchy about, you know, how much you break the fourth wall or not to allow a person to be involved.
I mean, so, to bring back to, I think, in our intro of this show, you asked, should you or when should you or how should you punish your players for metagaming?
Yeah.
I would twist that and say, don't punish them. Teach them how to do it right.
Okay.
Show them the kind of metagaming that's going to make the game fun for everyone, and the kind of metagaming that's going to make it unfun.
That seems good. In that educational process, what kinds of punishments do you serve out?
Okay, I do it back. So let me give you the example. I walked behind I mentioned before, saw one of my players looking up the dungeon in, you know, that we were about to play. So I changed it and I moved some things around and I did some stuff specifically so that when they said, oh, I know that there's a secret door under this rug, let me roll up the rug. Oh, it's a trap.
That's great. That's fantastic. I love it to death, and that's fantastic. I'll point. So our viewer William here makes a great actual point, and thank you for saying that, William, because I kind of wanted to say the same thing about the verbal communications between DM and player are not always perfect, and there are some things that would be visually stone cold obvious to any viewer. And maybe I'm, as DM, I'm not using the right language, or maybe not using the right language to connect to this player, or maybe I'm time constrained or something like that. And that is a great point. By giving at least a little bit of extra wiggle room and flexibility, metagaming wise, maybe stepping in and correcting an obviously bad mistake that the player is about to make, or at least giving options, or at least suggesting what the downside could be, is a really good capacity for the DM to be flexible about that. And the Raging Owlbear blog made the exact same point about this, about, you know, maybe I as DM have miscommunicated something, and to kind of give a safety buffer for that, it totally makes sense to assume that the character is a little bit more intelligent than the exact precise data that we've given them. That makes a lot of sense.
Great. I wonder if maybe this edges into yet another conversation that we can have someday. But it reminds me a lot of mapping, right?
Yeah.
Like how much do you describe, or how much detail do you describe the surroundings to the player who's drawing the map, and how many errors do you expect them to make? And right, at some point, when they say, "Will you just draw it for me?" Like, does that irritate you, or does that make you happy? Like, what's the right level of communication to go on there?
That's a really another great point. And again, I've seen one of the one of the original Gygax table players say that is an unforgivable mortal sin. Mm. Never ever help the mapper. The whole game, the essential thing about the game is exploring a horrible dungeon that you're confused by.
Yeah. But then you fall into these horrible loops of conversation. The tunnel goes 40 feet and then turns left. Well, is it actually 50 feet end to end? It goes 40 feet and then there's another 10-foot block where it turns left? Or is it go 40 feet in total and there's a left turn at the end of that 40 feet?
That happened yesterday with me playing under another DM. And I think that we are all trying to get better at, you know, and that's one of those things of, like, you know, the DM mapper communication. Practice of trying to make that cleaner and, you know, more obvious and faster. And once in a while I'll step in and go, well, it's basically a big triangle that goes like this with my finger, right? And you do that sometimes.
I definitely will, like, especially if the room is very odd shaped, I'll just draw it. I'm just going to draw this for you so I don't have to describe this weird shape that I don't know what the words are for. In our birthday game, right, I just used the projector and I just said, here it is. And so you had a perfect visual reference of it all the time. I don't know. Is that better or worse? I don't know. There is something amusing to, like, your map is slightly off, but I don't know.
I agree with that. And the funny thing is, as you know, when I play and if I'm mapping, I'm intentionally pretty sloppy about it. I'd never ask for, like, is it 10 feet this way or 10 feet that way? I'm like, it's a room and I'll be able to get back out when I need to.
Yeah, it's true. Ultimately, precision isn't hugely important as long as you can see, like, the big holes of maybe there's a secret room here because there's a big hole in the map. And I see X connects to Y. Great. Now I understand the layout a little better.
Right, that's right. For me, it's like, I mean, if you look at the first edition player's handbook, I mean, the number one thing is, can you get out?
Yep.
That's the number one thing. And okay. Then the number two is finding hidden spaces.
Potentially, question mark, maybe add mapping to our list of topics, although I yeah. agree with your hint for next week. Maybe we'll talk about mind control.
Yeah.
But let me give you one last metagaming example. Do you recognize the picture behind me, Dan?
Yes. Oh. Yes, of course, Paul. That is from Gary Conan last year at the Gary Gygax Chainmail Jousting Tournament.
Yes.
At which I went to after having done a couple weeks of statistical analysis of the game theoretical basis for the rules involved, and had to get in touch with a linear algebra researcher for his custom code that could do 20 variable Nash equilibrium solutions. And I came to the table with the best strategy I possibly could.
Excellent.
In that contest.
Was that metagaming?
and high quality metagaming, if I say so myself. you know, so I mean, you know, so that I think in the category of like war gaming, you know, collectible card gaming, you know, preparing before the show,
mm-hmm.
Obviously, you know, was it unfair cheating? Well, I mean, I didn't actually, you know, I got into the second round at least. I didn't win the event.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I seem to recall your end analysis was that like the best you could do was turn it into what, like a 2 in 3 chance of success or something, or maybe barely,
you know,
over 50.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, you know, like any Nash equilibrium, my friends, you know, the best you can do is match the strategy of the other person and make it 50-50, hypothetically.
Yeah, so a lot of luck in that game.
I mean, actually, the other thing is I realized they changed the rules, and I was, and my whole strategy wasn't actually really appropriate because they changed the rules.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, if I had my druthers, I would point out, like, yeah, but what kind of prep would we expect you to do? You're not going to, like, wear a bunch of heavy armor and ride around on a horse, because not only is that not going to help you,
right,
it's ridiculous, right? Like,
right.
But you do want to portray, I'm a knight who does a lot of jousts, and I'm practiced at that. And I think that, you know, we can totally apply Murky Mirror here and say, like, your preparation is the equivalent to a knight preparing to do joust. They're writing the lists, they're aiming at the little ring, and they're doing all the stuff a knight does to be better at jousting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I hadn't thought about that, but I'm willing to accept that shield. yeah, and you know, and it's like for me, it, like a lot of this, like the gaming shouldn't just be fun. Like it should be kind of educational. So if I learn something about history, I learn something about math, or statistics or game theory, I feel like all of that is a virtuous golden circle. So that certainly fed that metagaming fed into my life and my personal knowledge in a way that I was very happy about.
That's great.
Yeah. You know, I will say, you know, just not so as far as the chainmail jousting rule goes, I don't know if I've told you this, Paul, but I've actually, you know, in original D&D, it officially says you run into a fighter in the wilderness, they're going to challenge you to a joust. Use the chainmail jousting rules. And I have actually snipped that out of my games, as a matter of fact.
Mm.
And I think, as you know, when you were at the table, every time that would happen. So maybe this is actually like kind of like DM reverse metagaming right here, is every time I bring that to the table, I had, as DM, I had a very major level of knowledge about the strategy of choices behind that, and the players totally didn't.
Right.
This was the absolute first time the players had ever seen that.
Yep.
And the players would usually groan and go, oh no, here's the damn jousting table that we always lose at. I probably did that 2 or 3 times. And then I finally really parsed the complaint and went, yeah, this is it, assuming you had a body of players that had heavily played chainmail jousting and everybody at the table knew what that was, that's a fair mechanic. And
right.
If I come in and slap it on my players and they've never seen it before, that's really hugely unfair. So a couple weeks ago in a session that happened, the players ran into a high-level fighter in the wilderness, got challenged to a duel, you know, some people that had seen that before were really unhappy about that, right? We're like, no, don't challenge anyone to a joust. And a couple of players that hadn't seen that were like, well, it's a thing. I don't know. I'm a fighter. It's, you know, I don't see anything about
it.
Right. And then instead of the complicated jousting matrix, I said, we're just going to roll dice. We're going to roll dice.
Nice.
You're going to bonus. I'm higher level. I'm probably going to beat you. And they won, right? The players won. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So for the first time ever, they actually walked away, and the player that had done that went, I love jousting. This is great.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so wonderful.
Well, I mean, the nice thing is you grounded it in a mechanic that they're used to, so they felt like they could engage with it. You know, I could see, potentially, you know, you could run a game at a convention, say, and say, like, there's going to be a bunch of jousting in this game.
Yeah.
Read up. You have better know your you know, OD&D, your chainmail jousting rules, because it's going to happen. And I don't think that's too much of a give, and I think that would be a pretty successful and fun game, because players would come expecting it and possibly have done their homework, as you did at the tournament. And that might add something to the game. But yeah, just pulling it out in the middle of a random campaign and saying, guess what? We're playing this other weird thing now.
Yeah. It's a really great point, because I've seen some people, you know, some original D&D players recently, you know, arguing, we don't like 2000 era unified mechanics, right? We actually like having a bunch of unique mini games in our game that don't follow any unified mechanic. And I think there's a little, tiny little bit of nostalgia there, but based on this experience, that's a little bit unfair to new players.
Yep.
That is a little bit, so the nice thing about unified mechanics is you can throw, you know, some kind of unified E mechanic is you can throw a new situation at a halfway casual player and they can interface with it because they know D20 challenge bonus. I got it.
Yep.
But every time you come in and you throw down a brand new mini game, it's nice for the DM, but the casual player will not be able to interface with that.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah.
Great. All right. So we're running a little long. So
yeah.
What are your final thoughts on metagaming?
Let me get the card that I dropped. Yep. Got it. Right. Got it. Got it. Great. Good. I like it. Did I mention that? The first time I found the word metagaming, the first time I found the word metagame in Dragon Magazine was 1990. Did I say that at the top? I did say that at the top.
I already don't remember.
Anyway, whatever. Doesn't matter. I'm super generous, I think. Anything up to reading the adventure, I'm okay with, including people audio taping me and using that against me. As my campaign world has all kinds of sharp instruments aimed at the player characters, and I enjoy seeing the players bring anything they can in the opposite direction. So I'm pretty generous about it.
For me, it all comes back to the narrative. If you find a way to make it sense in the narrative and make it help and make it more enjoyable to everybody who's watching the game unfold, then I'm all for it. Where it really makes me unhappy is the cases where it's like, clearly this can't happen, right? You are across town from this player, and he is basing his actions based on things that you're finding out over here. It just doesn't make sense in physics. That's when I start to get unhappy. But again, like, if you can just come up with some kind of thinly veiled excuse as to why it works, I'm pleased.
I'm probably spoiled and biased with really excellent players where I have not been pinged as anything wrong in so long I can't remember it. So my opinion might be currently biased by the player quality that I currently have, which is amazing for me.
Well, excellent. If any of our listeners have further thoughts on metagaming, how to react to it, what level of it is okay and what level isn't, or how to prepare your players do it in a conscientious way such that it's pleasant for everybody at the table, I'd love to hear it. Please leave us comments in this video, give us all your other thoughts or ideas, then we'll happy to further our discussion down the road.
Thank you for the live comments today. I think that actually really benefited the discussion on metagaming that we just had. Remember that you can follow us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch by the handle WanderingDMs. You can get audio versions of our shows at all of the top podcast providers and also our website at wanderingdms.com. Thanks to our patrons who support the show. And if you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. We are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, so please join us next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.